Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 7th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Fred Niedner. It's session number 98-7 and is entitled, Lord, Remember Us in Your Kingdom and Bear Our Wounds. Let's listen in.
More still to restore the hope of healing, give us grace and make us still. Through the stillness with your spirit, come into our world of stress. For the sake of Christ forgiving, all the failures we confess. You in us are bruised and broken, hear us as we seek release from the pain of earlier living. Set us free and grant us peace. Send us, God of new beginnings, humbly hopeful into life. Use us as a means of blessing. Make us stronger, give us faith. Give us faith to be more faithful. Give us hope to be more true. Give us love to go on learning. God, encourage and renew.
Let us pray. Gracious Lord, as you know better than we do live in a broken world, and we are broken people. Be with us in our pain and sorrows. Take them on yourself as you have promised. Heal them, heal us, and make of us a healing community. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, today I forgot the bell. Yesterday I forgot the hilarity. For those of you who weren't here, last week or other times when I've done these Bible studies, I try to follow rigorously the Holden mission statement, which is on the wall in the next room back here, that says we do things at Holden in many, many ways and for all sorts of motivations, but we all also do them in a context of hilarity. And so I try to start sessions with a moment of hilarity in case some doesn't happen later. So we sort of take care of that and then take our chances on the rest of the... So I brought a piece of stuff from the internet. I was reading from that old lost Torah scroll to the first group, and I didn't even get a smile, so I figured, well, that was not hilarious. So this stuff from the internet will have to do. Someone sent me this. It's called The Facts of Life. The two most common elements in the universe are hydrogen and stupidity. If at first you don't succeed, skydiving is not for you. This one does sort of fit with the theme for the day, which is healing. Psychiatrists say that one of four people are mentally ill. Check three friends. If they're okay, you're it. Always remember to pillage before you burn. Here are a couple for the student population that I work with. If you're given an open book exam, you will forget your book. If you are given a take-home test, you will forget where you live. The trouble with doing something right the first time is that nobody appreciates how difficult it was. And finally, it may be that the sole purpose in life is simply to serve as a warning to others. That certainly is true of my life, if not of yours. Well, Well, healing is the name of one of the chapters in this book, and that has set our theme for the summer, practicing our faith. And this is the first chapter I've done in almost a week where the author wasn't here in the village. But the conversation has started. Walt Mongren's homily at Vespers last evening was on the subject of healing, and that's what we're doing this morning here. It's a huge subject. It's an enormous conversation, both in the culture as well as in the church. As this book chapter points out, many congregations of Christians and communities of Christians have rituals and services of healing. Now, people who didn't do this even just a few years ago, the self-help and health and fitness shelves in Barnes & Noble and B. Dalton and Amazon.com and everybody else is just chock full of books on healing of many kinds. So this is a big piece of conversation. We all want to be well, and we all want to be healed. It's a medical conversation, it's a mental health conversation. It extends everywhere. The Bible's oldest category for what we're looking for is the vanished.
They moved it next door.
Oh, okay. I had the word shalom written there, which is the Bible's word for hello, the Old Testament, excuse me, the original Bible, the one I teach. I teach Old Testament at Belleville. It's the word for hello, it's the word for goodbye, it's the word for health, it's the word for peace. It's what you inquire about when you check on the relatives. When Jacob sends Joseph off to find out how the brothers are doing, in Hebrew he goes off to ask, how's your shalom? How's everything with you? That's what health is in the scriptural tradition. It's not confined just to your fevers and your aches and your pains or your mood at the moment. It's the whole complex of how you are. That is the subject of shalom, and so it's the having or the not having of shalom that we're really talking about. There are many, many healing stories, or stories that we would call healing stories, in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. A lot more, obviously, in the New Testament because of how many narratives there are of Jesus healing people. But I thought we'd look at least one Old Testament story this morning, partly to show that in both Old and New Testament, these stories have always more than one agenda. They're never merely a story of a sick person getting well, thanks to someone or something, but always there's something else happening. So 2 Kings 5 is a fairly well-known story from the Hebrew Bible. And it's a long and complex story, so we're not going to do it in great detail, kind of do a hit-and-run job on it, if you will. It's in the lectionary, 2 Kings 5. It's in the lectionary, so it is a story that we hear every so often, along with the cleansing of the lepers in the New Testament. It's about Naaman, a commander of the army of the king of Aram. And the Arameans is another way to describe the Babylonian civilization off to the east the civilization from which Abraham and Sarah had migrated into the Promised Land, but a civilization which was, through much of the history of the biblical period, an enemy nation. So this is not just some outsiders. This is that that civilization with which Israel was so often at odds. And so it's one of their army heroes to whom the Lord had given a victory. So someone that at least God had an eye on. Now the Arameans, on one of their raids, verse 2, had taken a young girl captive from the land of Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. And so this young girl says to her mistress, oh, we forgot the line that this man had leprosy, sorry. So the young girl says, if only my Lord, not the Yahweh word for Lord, but my master, were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he could cure him of this leprosy. So Naaman went and told his master just what the girl from the land of Israel had said, and the king of Aram said, well, go, I'll send a letter along. And he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of garments. This is the ancient equivalent of medical insurance. He figures he's going to have to pay a lot for this. And so he heads off to find the healer that the young girl knows about. And without going through the whole thing, he finds Elisha the prophet, the man of God, ends up at the prophet's direction, washing in the River Jordan, being healed of his leprosy. And he is so very grateful, obviously. And this is a surprising method of cure. That's a funny part of the story. I mean, washing in the River Jordan is muddy. It's a dumb thing to wash in if you're trying to get clean. But it works. The man is cured, and he wants to give all this money he's brought along to the prophet. And the prophet says, no, that's not what this is about. This is a not-for-profit deal here, and just go in peace. So he does go in peace. He goes shalom. He goes whole home. He's fixed in a lot of different ways in this story. Then you get the little episode at the end in which a greedy guy has seen all this money, decides, ooh, we sort of blew that. And the servant of Elisha goes running off after Naaman and says, oh, the money, you know, we will take the money. And so he gets the money, and this ends up being a personal disaster for him. He's not healed. This is not a healing thing for him. So it's a healing story, but it's got, it's in here at this particular point for some complex reasons, one of which is that Israel's blessings and Israel's mission to the world is really, you know, meant to extend outside the boundaries of just the Israelite people. This was always a big issue, or at many points in Israel's history, this was an issue. But the oldest statement of what the point was of there being a chosen people in Genesis 12, 1-3 is, Abraham and Sarah, go from your place to the place that I will show you, because I want to have a people of blessing. Through you, I want to bless all the families of the earth. And so when Israel is being Israel, they are blessing everyone. Not, they aren't chosen just for their own sake. And there are many ways that prophets and narrative writers and others in the history of the Old Testament period found to remind the Israelites that this is who they are. You're God's agents of blessing, and not just for yourselves, but for all the families of the earth. So here is the story that in Israel there is healing, even for foreigners. And it's not for profit. We're not in this for the money. This is just who we are. You come here, there's healing here. So the story is a story about Israel's identity and Israel's mission among the families of the earth, not merely a story of a miraculous healing of a guy, which is, and it's also that. So, just like this one, most of the New Testament stories also have multiple agendas. So we'll move to Mark, unless somebody has a question about it.
Are there a lot of stories of healing in the Old Testament?
Not near as many. Hezekiah is healed or cured. He's about to die, and in the time of the prophet Isaiah, and there he prays and he is healed.
Elijah heals the widow's son.
Yeah, that's practically a resurrection from the dead. This child appears to be dead, and Elijah lays on the child and revives him.
Were Jewish people, then, their religion have an emphasis on healing then?
Nowadays?
Yeah.
I honestly don't know what's going on in synagogue traditions, whether there is, whether they would ever, for example, have a healing service like.
There's a tradition of repair of the earth and repair of people.
Yeah,
tikkun. Yeah. But the laying on hands business is not, the miraculous healing is not, except in very obscure kind of sects. Not something that's generally, thought of. It's actually, there's a lot of suspicion of that whole notion.
Yeah.
But the sort of spiritual and mental health and psychological soul healing is a big thing. And there's a lot of Jews who are psychologists. I mean, I think that sort of goes together.
Yeah. Thank you.
Question over here.
Not a question really, but what about the Psalms of Lament that talk about being afflicted and being ill and then rejoicing in Psalms when the person is well again?
Yeah, I would certainly take those to be prayers for what we would call healing, prayers for a return to shalom. And the way many of them are written, the dangers they describe are so, the descriptions could fit war, they could fit disease, they could fit your neighbors hating you, they could fit a lot of things. So, but all those things together would be, the issue would be the loss and restoration of shalom. Peace and healing are the same thing. Peace and health, no matter what you pray for, you're praying for shalom ultimately. Well, there's a cycle of stories at the beginning of Mark's gospel that I would like to have us look at just to see some of the issues and some of the language that surround healing stories to give us a clue as to what in the biblical world the whole topic of healing was about. Mark's gospel launches Jesus immediately into what you might call a ministry of healing, or you might call an assault on the powers that destroy people. other Gospels give us birth narratives and whatnot, but we go immediately in Mark to the baptism of Jesus. He's driven into the wilderness for just a couple of verses. Calls some disciples in Mark 1:16. And then by verse 21 of the very first chapter, we're already on our way. And we come to a Capernaum on the Sabbath at the synagogue. People are astounded at the teaching Jesus makes. And just then, verse 23, there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit who cries out, "What do you have to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Come to destroy us? I know who you are." Jesus rebukes him with a harsh kind of command that you would speak to an animal. Lots of languages have separate verbs for what animals do as compared to what humans do, like in German, eating essen and fressen. In Greek, there's a different way you address animals from the way you would address humans when you tell them to be quiet. And this is not the polite way. The big thing to notice here is what it is that's got this man yelling and screaming and carrying on like this in the normally orderly context of the synagogue service. This is a man who's owned by an unclean spirit. What's an unclean spirit? Well, you've heard about these all your life if you've been listening to Bible stories. So, you know, you may not even remember what an odd thing it is in English to talk about unclean spirits. Spirits, I mean, how do you get a spirit dirty? Well, a spirit, that word in the both Old and New Testament original languages means breath or wind. And it was the perfect metaphor for powers that were mysterious because you couldn't see them, you couldn't control them. They could appear and disappear. An unclean one meant any power or force that could render a person in Jewish ritual categories an outsider. Unclean was a category that meant outside the bounds of eligibility for performing the normal rituals of the faith, but also it meant you were an outsider to the community, or at least any community that was attempting to remain observant. And it seems also to have meant just about, the category of uncleanness extended to just about anybody you simply didn't really want in the community. So it extended to all Gentiles, people who touched Gentiles, ate with Gentiles, walked in Gentile territory, ate off Gentile dishes, entered a Gentile home. It included anybody with diseases or conditions that the Torah stipulated as being unclean. So as we'll see, leprosy and certain other diseases like that rendered you unclean. Fluid emissions rendered you unclean, menstruation, nocturnal emission, all sorts of things like that rendered you unclean, and you had to go through rituals of purification. So an unclean spirit was any sort of force whatsoever that put you in that category. Whether it made you scream and yell in the synagogue so that people threw you out, or whether it made your body do things that rendered you unclean no matter what. That was an unclean spirit, a power that made you an outsider. And so we might see here ourselves some sort of exorcism, or it's a simple thing. Jesus just yells at this power as though it were some sort of beast, and the thing submits. I don't know what you'd call it today. Some sort of psychosomatic thing that the power of suggestion overcomes. Hard telling. All we can do is see what the ancients thought was going on. A force that made a man scream in synagogues is banished, is no longer in control of this man. And he's no longer unclean. He's no longer an outsider. They immediately, upon leaving the synagogue, enter the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Simon's mother-in-law is in bed with a fever. They told him about her. He came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and the fever left her, and she began to serve. And the verb for what Jesus did there in verse 31, he lifted her up. There aren't a lot of words for doing that in Greek, but there are a few. It just so happens that the narrator here uses the same verb that he used for resurrection. When Paul, for example, speaks about God raising Jesus from the dead, this is the verb. So the narrator uses a loaded word here. He gave her life back. So it's language that's got more connotation to it than simply, I took the fever away. You know, it was bigger than that. He gave her life back. At sundown then, it seems like everybody comes to the door. Sick, possessed with demons, and demons is simply a Greek word for, or another Greek word for, powers and forces. Except as we'll see in a little bit, these are a little bit different than the kind of forces they talked about that were like breath and wind. These forces don't like water. But Jesus cures a whole lot of those people, verse 34. And here the verb, you'll recognize it even in Greek. It's pronounced therapeo, therapy. This is the verb from which we get that word. So Jesus does therapy on those who are sick, and he casts out many demons, and that's a very simple term, to throw out, just to ekbalo, to, well, that's what it means, pitch. And he silenced the demons because they knew who he was. And this is a theme throughout Mark's gospel, that the people Jesus is trying to convince never do catch on. The only people who ever catch on to Jesus' true identity as Son of God in the Gospel of Mark are either demon-possessed or Roman soldiers. Nobody else gets it. There's a leper story in verses 40 and following.
Could you explain that?
What?
How it is that demons and Roman soldiers will get it, where others don't.
Well, I take that to be a part of the larger purpose of the Gospel of Mark. This is not the way it is in the other Gospels. It's a little bit that way in Matthew, who picks up some of the same theme, but not all of it. But Mark, this is the theological theme in Mark, that Jesus appeared and no one knew who he was in amongst this people of this time. And my own, there are multiple readings of Mark's gospel, because all these gospels are anonymous and they don't come with a complete explanation of exactly what audience they were originally intended for. When you sort through these gospels and attempt to discern what kind of group was this written for, there are multiple suggestions for all the gospels, but for Mark, one option, and a very common one, is that it was written for persecuted people who were in that same position. They were a people whom the rest of the world didn't really understand. And in fact, the people who had to hide their identity as the sons and daughters of God, that is, baptized people. And so, like Jesus, they went around hiding that identity and speaking in code. And only later on, when the identity is revealed and the consequences of that is death, then you begin living openly with that thing you kept secret. So that's how I understand all this secrecy, and yeah, no, nobody who's really supposed to understand Jesus does. This leper story in verses 40 and following gives us a clue as to what kind of motivation there is for Jesus to do these things. Plus, it gives us yet another word for what happens to the man. In this case, the verb is not therapello anymore. The verb this time in this story is katharizo, from which we get words like catharsis and catheter. It's a cleaning word. But of course, that's the big problem with the leper, is you have this disease that makes you unclean. And in fact, in ancient Jewish society, these people had to go around declaring their uncleanness. If anyone got near them out at their leper colony, you may remember from some of the Bible stories, they had to yell out, "Tame, Tame, unclean, unclean." So you were sentenced for the rest of your life. It was your responsibility to keep everyone else away from you. And so it's fitting that the word for dealing with this problem is a cleaning word, catharsis. The motivation of Jesus is in verse 41. In the NRSV it says, "moved with pity." In the older translation it said, Jesus had compassion or was filled with compassion. And this is that Greek word that is used in many miracle stories. Jesus' insides were stirred. And it's an attempt to translate the Old Testament's Hebrew term for this, which means to womb somebody. The Hebrew word for having compassion is to say that you have, literally it means to have wombs.
Wombs,
W-O-M-B-S. That is, to treat somebody as though you were their mother. And you can remember that they were once inside you and you loved them even before you ever laid eyes on them. And so when you see them in difficulty later on, you have this thing for them that the neighbors might not have. So there are really bad termites on this building. This is a common piece of these miracle stories, that Jesus has this gut-wrenching sympathy for the people, and this is what calls forth from him the impetus to heal, in this case, to cleanse. Chapter 2 continues with the healing of a paralytic. And it's a story that shows us that there really is not much way to completely distinguish forgiveness from what we think of as healing. And I don't want to go into this story in great detail, but this is the story that results in the conversation about, what's really easier to do, to say forgive, your sins are forgiven, or get up and walk? And of course, in the mindset of that day, it's a whole lot easier to say, get up and walk, because only for God could forgive sins. And anybody could say, get up and walk, and it might happen, it might not. In another way, it's easier to say your sins are forgiven, because nobody can see whether it happens or not. You can say, get up and walk, and if it doesn't work, well, you look dumb. So this is a really interesting question. What is easier? But the real point is that these things are very bound up together. They're both parts of shalom, wholeness. Wholeness means being able to walk, and it also means being forgiven. I want to jump ahead. Well, we could look just for a moment at chapter 3. Again, we have a synagogue story, and there's a man with a withered hand, and it's really also an issue here of whether you can do such things on the Sabbath. But what they come to watch is whether Jesus will cure this man, and here we have another example of therapeuo. Do therapy on this guy. So remember that we have another verb here. We got catharsis and therapy that Jesus does. But chapter 5 is where I'd like to move next. And check out other dimensions of how this giving of shalom works. The story of the Gerasene demoniac was in the lectionary in the Lucan version just a couple of weeks ago, and if you were up here in the village, Susan Briel preached a wonderful sermon on this. This is a highly complex story because of all the levels of uncleanness and lack of shalom that are in this story. Jesus goes to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, to the country of the Gerasenes, and there's a bunch of footnotes because nobody really knows what this is, and a lot of scribes tried to fix the text, so we got Gadarenes and Gergesenes and Gergesenes and Gerasenes and whatnot. But when he steps out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs. No one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain. People had tried a lot, but he'd broken the chains and shackles apart. Verse 5, night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with stones. When he saw Jesus, he ran. And here's another possessed person who seems to have some clue as to who Jesus is, as regular human beings don't. Well, I don't know what sort of diagnosis you'd make of this fellow on the basis of modern understandings of these things. Clearly a tortured individual, not any longer under the control of normal human faculties. But from an ancient perspective, this is a real mess. Just look at the levels of uncleanness here. For one thing, we are off on the other side of the Sea of Galilee in Gentile territory, which could lead you to ask, what's Jesus and his crew even doing over there? The genuinely pious people didn't even go such places because it's Gentile territory and you're going to have to clean yourself up even for going there. And here's a man who's living in tombs and he's living naked. There's two more uncleannesses. You're not supposed to touch dead bodies unless you're the next of kin and during a very short window of time after death. And here's a man who's out there, I mean, these are his roommates. this is virtually unspeakable uncleanness. So in Gentile territory, living in tombs, living naked, and not only that, we didn't get quite to this point, we are living in the presence of thousands of pigs. And you know about pigs, right? According to Torah. It's hard to imagine any more uncleanness than this. And so the remarkable thing of this story is not just that Jesus cures a guy that we would call, you know, schizophrenic or something. This is an amazing story of cleaning up a whole region that is unclean in every possible way. So this is the restoration of shalom as that culture would have understood it for a whole territory. Because what happens is the unclean making forces, the unclean spirits are removed from the man and put into the pigs, and the pigs rush into water and demons can't stand water. And so everything is, you know, cleaned up. Now, that's why this is the only story in Mark's Gospel where Jesus says at the end, go tell somebody. Because this place is safe. Of all the places in the universe now, this place is totally clean and clear. And shalom is here and you can talk. Every place else in Mark's Gospel, at the end of the story, Jesus says, but don't tell anybody, because of course we're still surrounded by all this hostility. But here we have one place that's cleaned up. A week ago in the village there was a woman who'd spent some years in New Guinea, and she was telling us the difficulty of teaching certain Bible stories in that culture, and she said this story makes them weep in New Guinea because pigs mean everything. In New Guinea, that's their livelihood, is raising pigs. And to think of, you know, how could Jesus, of all people, destroy 2,000 pigs? And this is a terrible, sad story. Pardon me?
I'm thinking about the effect on the lake of 2,000 dead pigs in the lake.
Well, we certainly couldn't tolerate that at Holden, for sure. Right, pollution.
Is the ritual then of cleansing involve water because the demons can't stand water? I don't know what the rituals are.
I've never studied demonology enough to know why they said demons can't stand water. I honestly don't know.
But is water involved in the cleansing then?
I've also never checked to see if every place where demons are conquered in the New Testament water is involved. I doubt it.
There's a modern version for the Orthodox Jews called the mikveh, where women who are going through their menstruation have to, well, they immerse themselves in water, basically.
Yeah.
It's not holy water or anything like that. It's just water.
And, yeah. And
they still, that practice is still done, but just by very Orthodox.
Yeah, ritual washings are all over the place in the Hebrew Bible, but they have nothing to do with demons. And the language of demons is not there. But this is the washing from uncleanness. And every kind of uncleanness practically requires it. But this business of attributing this situation to demons, demon is a Greek category.
My question was water involved in cleansing?
Yeah, the water is always involved in the cleansing. And this is one of the reasons why baptism is such a link for us to that tradition. I thought you were asking about demonology, which is...
I don't care about that.
Yeah. That's a piece of Hellenistic culture that gets into New Testament as an interpretation of what's wrong with people.
I was just going to say, so you're saying that that space, the tombs, everything are cleaned up, but that the whole territory is cleaned up now, the quote Gentile, or just that?
Well, that's the picture, you know, for the moment, this is a place that has been cleaned. All the forces of uncleanness have been handled in this territory.
The whole territory.
Well, this little...
That little spot, that's what I'm saying.
This place where they went, which is across the Sea of Galilee, you know, as it were, wholeness has been brought here. And for the moment, this is a safe place, or a healed place.
How does that fit with the people who want Jesus to leave, who beg him to leave? I guess I would assume that if Shalom existed, it would include their welcome.
Yeah. Well, that's right. It's not like exactly the kingdom has come, because this is a really frightening prospect to some people. And part of what Walt was getting at last night in his homily, healing is painful. We often resist going through the pain that it takes to get healed. We don't want the surgery. We don't want to go through recovery. We want to go straight from addiction to health. Forget the pain in between, and so forth. You know.
What do we make of not just the uncleanness here in the spirit, but this sort of superhuman strength?
In this guy?
Chains. Yeah, the guy prior to he's breaking chains apart to cease.
I don't know. Any mental health professionals here? Does this look like it?
When I'm a nurse, and when I went through my affiliation at the psych hospital, it's not uncommon for superhuman strength. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Interesting to me that they had him bound, but it doesn't really say what he had done that would make them afraid of him.
Yeah.
And he actually broke the chains, but he's still bound.
Yeah.
What you can also see in with the chronically ill and someone in a manic state in particular, not only very superhuman strength and kind of wild behavior, but also an uncanny ability to see to the heart of a person. I mean, they can sometimes spot a weakness in a therapist or a clinician or a funny mannerism, and they'll pick up on that and, you know, not afraid to kind of drill that home. So on the one hand, this bizarre, wild, crazy behavior, but on the other hand, boy, they can really look at a truth that's there in another individual. They tend to tap it sometimes, but
yeah.
And you see that here.
Yeah.
So it's, you can see Jesus.
Yeah.
As God, and cuts through the chains.
So this is somebody who we would have our ways of diagnosing and categorizing with things that we witness too. It's just that we see here a different way of naming and understanding that.
What about the fact later on when Jesus is asked to leave because they're afraid of him? If he has the power to cast this demon out of this person, they're afraid of the power he has. What might he do to them? And it's almost like he immediately gets in the boat and tells the man who was possessed, please go tell your people this has happened. But he's kind of making a quick exit because maybe the crowd's becoming a little unmanageable.
Yeah, I took the fear of him, that's what I was commenting on when I said, you know, healing is always disruptive because now you got to find a new way to be and a new way to live, and this is not necessarily going to make life easy. As far as Jesus moving on and the crowds, that's a building theme at this point in Mark's gospel, that Jesus is moving quickly and rapidly, and the word immediately, as many of you know, is the favorite word in Mark's gospel. And this thing is just moving very rapidly, and the crowds are chasing Jesus all over the region by this time.
They're chasing him away. It says they beg him to leave.
Yeah, the crowds are very fickle in Mark's gospel. The crowds are clamoring for Jesus to help them. The crowds are chasing Jesus. Eventually, the crowds want him crucified. It's always, and it's, we're never told that this is a different crowd. It's just that there's always crowds in Mark's gospel. This whole peripheral population.
In psychological terms, the defense you know is always more comfortable than the one that you have to create after that one's gone.
Yeah.
And that also extends to social psychology, not just individual.
Yeah.
Okay, you helped me get past this defense that has maladaptive consequences, but that's enough. Yeah. I don't want any more.
Right. We know how to deal with the crazy guy. We try to chain him up, and he breaks out, and we can see him. But now you've shown us that you're stronger than he is, and we don't know how to defend ourselves against you. So please leave before something else happens. we'll chain you up.
Are you discounting the idea of an actual demon having come in and possessed it instead of just a psychological problem?
I'm not sure that ancient people had an understanding of mental illness per se. I mean, it was...
Well, yeah, but...
You know, the frame things in terms of...
the way I see it... Pardon me. We could decide that, you know, the world was once filled with demons and they aren't around anymore and now we just have mental illness. Or we could decide that we're deluding ourselves and there are a lot of demons around today and we're just misnaming it. Or we could decide that was their way of diagnosing and understanding powers that wrecked people's lives that they didn't completely understand. We recognize those same powers and we handle them with our best efforts, but we don't call them demons anymore, we call them these other names.
I tend to think that there is a power of evil around.
Well, there surely are.
And it's not just a psychological.
And the point is not that there aren't powers of evil anymore, the point is that, you know, these words, you know, demons and unclean spirits, these are names for forces that wrecked people's lives. They weren't like creatures that were running around loose with names and IDs, you know, that were individual characters. These are forces, these are mysterious powers that destroy people.
And your question gets to the issue, how important are miracles? Because the notion of demons goes along with the notion that there's also some force of good that's somewhat unknowable and special and miraculous to get rid of those demons.
Yeah.
And we don't today, for less, you know.
And maybe the issue we should jump to quickly, since we're rapidly running out of time again, because I chose too many texts once again. Yesterday I chose one and we didn't get to and today we try to do two testaments. Well, miracles are maybe happening around us today. You know, healings are happening around us today. But we aren't calling them exorcisms and demons having been run off. But the same things are happening. Healings are happening. They really are.
Have you ever encountered a situation like this where you might have encountered a quote demonic force or dark?
I've witnessed people playing with this. I was a dormitory director for a few years at Valparaiso, and I had some students call me up one night to ask me to deal with a kid who was going to kill someone in another dorm. And I said, what's going on? And they said, well, he's a new Christian and the devil's trying to get him back by making him kill this girl. And I said, will you come up and do an exorcism? And I said, no, I won't, but I'll call the police. And they said, oh no, we'll handle it. And they took care of it because they were playing with this. You know, that's all I've ever witnessed. I've never truly been in a circumstance where I was faced with something more exorcism would have been appropriate.
I've worked with mentally ill for a number of years, and there was one instance where it were truly staff, clinicians, there were even some clinicians who felt that this person had some kind of possession. And he talked in a robotic voice, and diagnostically, autistic from early on and such, but his behavior was very calculated at times. It seemed to switch back and forth between cooperative behavior or very violent, sudden, what seemed impulsive, but actually was fairly calculated kind of stuff. And he had amazing quickness, and staff truly believed that there was some kind of possession there. And it was so unusual from all the other people I worked with, the whole gamut, from psychotic, schizophrenic, manic, depressive, people with long histories of institutionalization and those kind of things. But this one particular individual was truly unique in something like a renaissance. So I, who's to say, but I'm really struck by the challenge of having worked with mentally ill and seeing them so outside of community, but that is still very real. We don't fit into the norms, and if we are really challenged, and some of their behavior is scary or repulsive, and we are really challenged, I think, by this too. Or whether it's a chronic illness where, someone's got an illness that it's not going away. We're really challenged.
Those of us in Washington, Oregon, and all of you I know are aware of a lot of youth violence, but we're particularly kind of overwhelmed with this terrible thing that happened down in Springfield. And so my head has been stuck on the first March story you've been talking about with the unclean spirit, and then all your description of how that fits many different kinds of people. And we still don't have an answer for it today, because the boy Kip could have had an unclean spirit. And then you went on to describe what that meant, and that's why I got stuck with it, being an outsider. To be unclean was to be an outsider. And then you go on to look at these kids. They all feel like outsiders, mm-hmm. these dreadful things that happen. Mm-hmm. So then I'd love to get on to the next step, which we discussed yesterday in that one class over there. What do you do about it? And we didn't find the answer. Mm-hmm. It's such a terrible, how do you help people become part of the community?
Well, the one thing you see here, Jesus, I mean the model, or a model, is A, having compassion, and B, going into their territory. You don't let them stay off there in the region of the Decapolis and howl at the moon. You know, you go there and risk getting unclean yourself by having some tomb dweller touch you.
Well, and with that too, and people are talking about Jesus going away. To me, I don't know if that womb love word is used in that particular story, but to me, there's a lot of compassion went for the people as well as for this person who's been on the outside to say, you go. You now you go into that territory and yeah. You're not on the outside anymore. Right. I am sending you in.
Yeah.
And okay, I understand that you're afraid of me all, but who were you more afraid of before? And now that one can become your friend.
Yeah.
To me, there's something real powerful in that.
Yeah. There is.
Jesus really goes out of his way here, doesn't he? Clear across the other side of the lake, out of the place. We don't even know, we can't even say the place where it was.
It's right, the scribal tradition couldn't even figure out where it could have been.
Yeah.
It went nowhere.
Yeah.
Nowheresville. One other, we have to quit, but there's one other story I would invite you to think about for communities of healing, which is a big piece of this. The gospel lesson from about a month ago in Luke 7, 1-10, in which a centurion wants his servant healed, so he sends somebody to talk to Jesus, and then Jesus gets close, and he sends somebody else to say, oh, don't bother, come and just say the word, and the servant gets healed. This is an amazing story, because this is the story of God healing somebody, and the two never come in touch. The whole story happens with intermediaries. Jesus is God's emissary, and there's two sets of emissaries that come to talk to Jesus, and the slave gets healed. And everything happened in here. And my question would be, this is clearly a story in which a community or a set of communities, they all own a piece of this man's problem. Your sickness is never your own. The sickness infects everybody in the story, whole communities. One sick slave, and the whole community is caught up in it. And one question I'd ask is, given the fact that the whole community started to bear this illness, if the patient had died, would there still have been healing? Mm-hmm. When we go over here in this village center and kneel down and pray and hold each other and weep and stuff, and the people we're praying for die, has healing happened? Mm-hmm. I think it has, because that person hasn't died alone. We're all going to die. And the point of shalom is not to die cut off, not to die alone, not to die unprayed for. I mean, his slave died eventually, but he was never again going to die alone.
Wouldn't the greatest healing be going to God?
Well, that's what we would say, sure, to be at one with God is shalom, yeah.
So
here, there,
where would obviously be happening.
Yeah. We better stop. Thank you very much.